and welcome. Welcome to Perimeter Institute's Public Lecture Series. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Senior Director of Public Engagement and Advancement here at Perimeter Institute. Before we begin this evening, in the spirit of respect and reconciliation, we acknowledge that Perimeter Institute is located upon the lands that have been inhabited by Indigenous peoples from the beginning. In particular, we acknowledge the Haldimand Tract, the traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg, the Odawandran, and the Haudenosaunee peoples. As settlers, we thank all of the generations of people who have taken care of this land for thousands of years. We are connected to our collective commitment to make the promise and the challenge of truth and reconciliation real in our communities. Tonight's lecture is part of Perimeter's Public Lecture Series. It's our longest-running public outreach program. Perimeter is a not-for-profit organization, and these public science events are part of our commitment to sharing exceptional and engaging science. We are fortunate to be able to continue to present this series, albeit virtually. Tonight, I'm broadcasting from a socially distant studio here at Perimeter, and our speaker will be broadcasting from the comfort of her own home. So, as you watch the lecture, I encourage you to join the conversation online. We are at Perimeter on Twitter, and you can use hashtag PILive to chat with Perimeter scientists and to ask questions of tonight's guest speaker. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Dr. Karen Hallberg. Dr. Hallberg is a professor of physics at the Balseiro Institute and principal researcher of the Argentine Council for Science and Technology, working at the Belaroche Center Atomic Center. She is an expert in quantum condensed matter physics and has developed state-of-the-art computational approaches to understanding nanoscopic systems and new exotic materials. She is a member of several national and international organizations, including the Argentine Committee for Ethics in Science and Technology, the Latin American Academy of Sciences, the American Physical Society, and the editorial board of the Physical Review Research, among many others. In an already decorated career, Dr. Hallberg's many honors include the 2019 L'Oréal UNESCO Award for Women in Science, which recognizes five outstanding international scientists annually. She is a strong advocate for ethics in science, as well as the field's inclusion of women and other historically disadvantaged groups. Tonight, she will share how she is able to apply advanced computational techniques to advance the field of quantum condensed matter. Everyone, please welcome Dr. Karen Hallberg. Karen, thank you so much for joining us. How are you and where are you?
Hello, Greg. Hello, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to our quantum world. I'm in Argentina, in the south of Argentina. I'll show you in a second in the map where we are, because we're falling off the map of America. So we're right south. It's springtime here, nearly summer. So we still have light outside in spite of it being after nine. So thank you so much for the invitation, Greg.
We are so, so honored to have you with us today. Thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing. And you know, the little dig about spring, that's nice. We have a snowy winterland, but it gets dark. It feels like around 4 p.m. already. So this will be a wonderful way to start our evening. And I know it's already late where you are. So thank you for staying up a little later too. Over to you. Enjoy.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Greg. Well, it's a great honor to be here, and it's a pleasure to having been invited to this very relevant and important public lecture series that Perimeter is organizing. So I'm very thankful for that. I thank the Perimeter Institute. I thank Marie Strickland as well. She contacted me, and I congratulate you for the program, because it's we are also using it a lot here, and we have access to the talks. And I think it's very important to bring science to the general public. So thank you once again. I want to share my screen, because we physicists are used to talking with PowerPoint presentations. Well, I want to talk to you about the fascinating and weird world of quantum matter. This is something we're working on, and I hope at the end of the talk to have brought you a little bit of the idea of the fascinating of this fascinating world and what is really encouraging our everyday work and what is what we are passionate about. So this is the previous slide is an aerial view of our lake in Bariloche. We're looking towards Chile, so those are the Andes, and that's our lake. We're very close to that lake. This is where we are actually. This is South America. You can see Bariloche in the south. Argentina is in sort of light green, and Bariloche, we are in the Patagonia, and we're in the border with Chile. It's a very big ski resort. It's also a very green and beautiful national park. So this is an aerial view also of our Bariloche Atomic Center and our Balseiro Institute. So here you have the campus in between both two lakes and in the middle of the mountains. So you're all very welcome to come and visit. It's very touristic and very beautiful. So here we have a very strange coalescence of high profile science and a national lab together with beautiful nature. So let me introduce you to the topics. In this talk, I will very briefly introduce you into this fascinating world, but real world of quantum mechanics. Then later on, I will introduce you to the concept of what is called emergent phenomena and complexity. To make it even worse towards the end, I will then unite both worlds, the world of the quantum world and the world of complexity, to show you some even more fascinating properties of condensed matter physics. That is, when atoms are put together and when they start interacting with each other, this might give, and in fact it does, give rise to new and unpredicted behavior called emergent phenomena. Nowadays, quantum mechanics is very well established. It's a standard theory. And it is a framework to describe the behavior of nature, mainly at atomic and subatomic scale. It was developed around over 100 years ago by several people, very prominent people who really were very creative in coming up with this very strange theory for that time and even now. We can mention, for example, the work done by Max Planck, who was able to model the spectral density distribution. Sorry, I'll be a little bit more technical or less technical, but this is to some people might even be interested in or may have already a background in quantum mechanics, so please bear me with that. So while Max Planck, what he did is he tried to explain what is called the spectral energy distribution of the light emitted by heated objects in the ideal heated objects, what is called the black body. And he had to assume a distribution of energies, but a discretized distribution of energies inside the material to be able to explain the outcome. So the classical result, which is this black line here, had a divergence for very low wavelengths or high frequencies, and that classical theory could not explain what was happening to this black body radiation. So Max Planck had to discretize the energy levels inside this black body to be able to explain it. At the same time, a couple of years later, Albert Einstein also explained the photoelectric effect. The photoelectric effect is that we shine light on a material or metal, for example, and we kick out electrons. And the results were not understood. So Einstein also postulated that the light has to be formed by discrete quantized particles. So little bits of particles that later on were called photons because of light. Whose energy or the energy of these small particles is proportional to the frequency or the wavelength of the corresponding wave. And so they came up, both of them, Max Planck and Einstein, with this formula, which is the energy is proportional to nu. This nu, the Greek letter, means a frequency, or is inversely proportional to the wavelength. So here we have different wavelengths of the light. We have a long wavelength, which is the light which is red, has a longer wavelength. The light, which is blue, has a shorter wavelength, and the energy of these quantized packets is proportional to the inverse of the wavelength. The proportionality constant called H is called Planck constant now, and And this Planck constant has been measured to a very, very high degree of accuracy, which is the value is here, is 6.9 digits. And these are significant digits, 10 to the minus 34 kilogram square meter by second. And now even this H is used since last year to define the kilogram. So it's a very important constant of nature. But there is another more fashionable or more interesting H, which is weird, called H bar, which is H divided by 2 pi. Planck constant is now very fashionable and is also used for other things, like, for example, T-shirts or even for labeling good wines, like in the Pedro Pascual Science Center in Benasque. I visited in February this year, and they had a delicious wine, which is called Quantic and has H-bar as its label. We also use it at the Alumni Association of the Balsero Institute. Here, the first logo is also H-bar. So it's a very nice letter, but it's one of the fundamental constants in nature. Some years later, it became clear that not only light can behave like particles, but also particles like electrons can also behave like waves, depending on the experiments. This is a so-called particle-wave duality. This can easily be explained, and in fact, it has been observed in the double split experiment, which I'm showing here. This experiment was originally proposed by Young for light waves, here to the left, where an incident light passes through two slits, a double slit, and forms an interference pattern here, the interference between the light waves of the two slits. And then they form this interference pattern at the screen, at the end, at the back screen behind the slits. In a surprising similar manner, electrons beamed through two slits in a similar way also form an interference pattern, like it's shown here. This is an experimental result made by Tonomura in 2007. And they also form interference patterns, as you see. But the weird thing is that even if we throw one electron at a time, you can see how they fall onto the screen. And finally, when many electrons are shown onto the system, they form a similar interference pattern as what happened with light. So then one can define a wave associated to the electron whose length is proportional. Inversion here, this is lambda, the wavelength of the electron now. Now the electron is not a particle, but it's a wave whose wavelength is inversely proportional to the frequency through, again, our old friend, the Planck constants, also through H. And the mass is also in the denominator. Quantum theory also allowed us to understand atomic orbitals, like, for example, the hydrogen wave function, the hydrogen orbitals shown here for different levels. All these are atomic wave functions at different energies surrounding the nucleus of the hydrogen. And this is a wave function here, how we describe mathematically these wave, the distribution of electrons in at different energies surrounding the proton. One of the weirdest properties is quantum entanglement. What is quantum entanglement? It is when it is a quantum state when the particles are locked and cannot when they're locked into one particular state, which we describe this what is a state in quantum mechanics, and this cannot be described as the states of the individual separated particles. Like, for example, here we have two electrons. Each electron now has another quantum property that is called the spin, which is a magnetic moment of the electron. The spin is like a, when one can show it like an arrow, it can be pointing up or down. And if these two particles are in an entangled state, like this one encircled here with ellipse, then it is neither up nor down. And then when we do a measurement on the system, we quench this state and we only see one of the states. Like, for example, we quench and we fix the up state of the electron, so of the electron, the up projection. So this immediately projects the other state in the other in the other electron. So this is the entanglement, and it's very important for what we're going to see now in a while, which are quantum computers. The another weird property, the last one I'll mention now, is the uncertainty principle, Werner Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that states that show that he never knew where he was, because he says that the Heisenberg Department of Physics, you say you're probably here, but probably here. So there's a cloud of probability, or that I'm going to be close to my office in the physics department. But the uncertainty principle states that we cannot know with very high precision the position and the velocity, or more precisely the momentum of a particle. So always this is an exact equation that says that the uncertainty in the position at times the uncertainty in velocity or momentum has to be always larger than h bar over 2. That means that we cannot know very precisely the position and momentum at the same time. Equivalently, energy and time cannot be measured precisely. But you cannot know the precise energy of a particle at a certain time. You must measure during long times to get a precise energy, and so you don't know at what time you've measured it. And vice versa, a particle at a certain time has large fluctuations in energy, and you cannot know precisely what energy it has. This leads to the well-known tunnel effect, the tunnel effect where particles like electrons suddenly tunnel through high energy barriers. I mean, here there's an electron coming from the left towards the right. Here we have a high energy barrier, and the electron classically could not go through that barrier, but quantically, yes, it can, because there is a finite probability that the electron can go through that tunnel barrier. And this is a wave function. The wave function is finite and not zero within the barrier. This is the basic mechanism behind STMs, which STM stands for scanning tunneling microscope. The scanning tunneling microscope is a tip like this here, where we're showing the individual atoms here, and this blue is the surface. The tip of the STM is in red, and through tunneling effect, electrons go back and forth here from the tip to the sample, and then we can, thanks to STM, we can see, thanks to this instrument, individual atoms on a surface, and we can even see the wave-like probability distribution of electrons inside here. Here we have ellipses formed by cobalt atoms placed on the surface of gold. And the colors are a little bit artificial, but as you see here, we have a confined system. The electrons within this form wave patterns like on the surface of a drum. And this is a solution that one can calculate with the wave functions and with the Schrödinger equation. And one can actually observe this like in Manoharan's IBM experiment done several years ago. So this is really, really surprising. And this experiment is very, very beautiful. Well, however, in spite of, or maybe because of this very special physical behavior, behaviors, uncertainty, the particle wave duality, wavy probabilistic behavior, entanglement, maybe because of all this, quantum physics is becoming ubiquitous in technology. So all this fascinating and weird behavior, like we say, can really be useful in technology. So, for example, let's mention some modern technology based on silicon, like here. Silicon is the basics of the transistors, and the transistor is one of the inventions that most contributed to the evolution of electronics. Then, and chips, for example, no? This is the classical chip. Then we have lasers. Laser stands for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. Here we have lasers of different colors. The laser is a macroscopic manifestation of quantum physics, because it's an emission at a pure wavelength that comes by the different components that form the laser. Other applications of quantum technology, well, here we see the levitation property of a superconductor. This is a magnet, and this circle is a superconductor. So this is also another quantum superconductivity. It's a quantum manifestation, a macroscopic manifestation of quantum physics. Then we have other applications like quantum sensors, to measure, for example, radiation, pollution in water, pollution in air. We also apply quantum for biomarkers, for fuel cells, for medical applications, so many medical applications, MRI, radiotherapies, laser technology, PEDS, which is positron emission therapy, drug delivery systems, precision medicine, etc. And of course, the queen of them all is quantum computing. This is a photo that impresses me quite a bit because it's a Google Sycamore processor. I show it here because there are many other companies, IBM, and many other companies that are also trying, and they have achieved some quantum computing, although with still very few qubits. And so this is still in the beginning. I mean, the quantum computers are being built, but they are still in the beginning. So there are many, many problems that have to be solved, mainly error correction, decoherence, and interaction with the environment. So scientists around the world are laying the groundwork for the first useful quantum computer. What is a quantum computer? So let's see what a conventional computer is. Bits in a conventional computer store either zeros or ones in two different states of matter. They are quite big, I mean, comparing to what one can do with a quantum computer. But in a quantum computer, the qubits, which are the elementary components of a quantum computer, can store a zero, a one, or both at the same time, like in an entangled state. So this is what makes them very special, and this is what makes them so potentially useful for huge computations. Exploiting this entanglement or this superposition property and other quantum effects, a quantum computer could rapidly make calculations that would take a conventional computer the age of the universe to solve, or not even solve the problem at all. For example, until recently, only a handful of qubits had been strung together in a device. Quantum computers have about 15 qubits that have been realized. This number is thought to be what is needed for the quantum supremacy. What does quantum supremacy mean? This is what Google announced last year in a paper published in Nature, this quantum supremacy using a programmable superconducting processor. This is a paper by Google. Quantum supremacy means that a quantum computer outperforms conventional supercomputers on certain tasks that one can calculate with a quantum computer, something that cannot be calculated with a classical computer, or, as they say, can take many, many years to calculate. These tasks that can be calculated with quantum computers include developing better drugs, designing new materials, accurate weather and climate modeling, cryptography, even finances and optimization problems, communications. And all of these are very complex problems, and many of them are called exponential problems because the amount of time you need to calculate something precisely is exponential. So quantum computers can do many calculations at the same time simultaneously thanks to the entanglement and quantum properties. So, this I think is so fascinating. This is really fascinating, weird, as we say, is something completely unexpected. And when I come to think about these physicists that came up with a theory some over 100 years ago, one has to really think, I mean, how can anybody tell me how these guys came up with such new ideas, these creative ideas, how is it that they found, they had experiments to explain, and instead of being incremental, instead of trying to build on something they knew, they came up with something completely new, completely disruptive, and they came up with this quantum theory. So this is something interesting of science, that sometimes you have to use lateral thinking to come up with a completely new idea. One has to be very, very creative sometimes to not continue linearly with what one knows, but really bring in new ideas, disruptive ideas. And this is something fascinating about science. Let me go now to the second part. There's another very fascinating concept in science, which is that of emergence and complex behavior. So this is also another concept I want to convey to you. the concept of emergence. Let me just read you what the U.S. National Academies defined as the emergence. So emergence phenomena in condensed matter and material physics are those that cannot be understood with models that treat the motions of the individual particles within the material independently. Instead, the essence of emergence phenomena lies in the complex interactions between many particles that result in the diverse behavior and often unpredictable collective motion of many particles. It's in short, is when we put particles together, the total is much more than the sum of the individual particles. What does Phil Anderson say in his book, More is Different? He says that the reductionist hypothesis that does not by any means imply a constructionist one. The ability to reduce everything to simple fundamental laws does not imply the ability to start from those laws and reconstruct the universe. So what he means is that at different scales, we need to come up with new ideas, and we do not need to build a theory from scratch to understand nature at different energy scales. That's what he means, that the reductionist hypothesis does not mean the inverse possibility. Bob Laughlin, also a Nobel laureate, he said everything that matters nowadays in science is organizational. The reductionist fundamental approach has stopped from being useful. Some people might not agree with this, but what it is important is that at every scale, we have to simplify the problem as much as we can, but we also have to try to extract the important information and not deal with a lot of information that is not useful. So how do we do to organize the information we are dealing with? This is what we have to try to put our imagination, our intelligence, to try to organize the information we're getting in order to be able to explain and understand nature. So let me tell you some examples of emergent phenomena, not necessarily quantum. At the end, I'm going to bring in the quantum mechanics. But for example, we can have ant colonies. The individual pieces are ants, and the interactions are pheromone trails. So we have individual pieces that have interactions, and then they give a complex behavior. What is consciousness, for example? The individual pieces and neurons. We don't even know what consciousness is, but we do know that we have neurons and that we have neural connections and firing, but we don't know how consciousness emerges as an emergent phenomenon. So, for example, if we have one neuron, two neurons, three neurons, which is the critical number of neurons we have to sample together above which consciousness emerges. Does it depend on the number of neurons, or does it depend on connectivity, or what does it depend on? So we cannot get consciousness by adding up the individual behavior of neurons. Same happens, for example, in the schooling or flocking, where we have fish or birds and interaction, and then you see this beautiful schooling of fish and birds and beautiful movements, and they have a collective behavior that is very difficult to reproduce. Etc. Stock markets, and you can also talk about many different things. But I want to concentrate in emergent phenomena in what I know and I work with is within condensed matter theory. Let me give you an example of emergent phenomena in quantum condensed matter. For example, in this very interesting paper of Science 2012. They did an experiment where they started putting together water molecules. So they have H2O, water molecules, and they start putting together water molecules. Like here, for example, to the left, they have 123 water molecules, and this is an amorphous system. Then they go adding more and more water molecules until they find a critical number, which is around 290, above which they find a crystalline order emerging in this system. So the main question they were asking is there a critical number of water molecules above which crystal order emerges? So this number was around 290. So this was interesting. Another question we can ask is, what if we combine now the quantum weirdness and complexity. So now this is where we have, we understand, now we know what quantum physics or quantum mechanics is. We know what emergence is, what happens when we have many particles interacting, and then this gives rise to completely new behavior. Now, what if these individual actors are quantum? So now we're going to mix both worlds, and I'm going to bring you into my world, I mean our world, people who work in quantum condensed matter, where we find fascinating physics. Let me give you an example about what happens, for example, in condensed matter. One interesting feature is that comes out because of correlation is what is called the charge and spin separation of the electron. We know that the electron has a charge, which is E, the negative charge of the electron, and it has a spin, as I defined before. The spin is the magnetic moment of the electron. Okay, so one electron has those two properties. Now let's draw the electrons here, like I'm showing in this cartoon. This black spin down means an electron facing with spin down. This one is an electron with spin up. What happens in some systems, and one can theoretically calculate it very precisely, is that if the interactions are strong, one can separate the charge and the spin of the electron. The charge has its own dynamics. The spin acquires its own dynamics. And these two quantum properties can become completely independent, like what is happening here. If I do a photo emission like Einstein used to do, and I take an electron out, I kick an electron out of the system, I take it away, far away, then here is a remaining hole, which is positive. And then this hole can move, can hop to the right, like here. And this other electron can hop to the left. As you see, then this hole and this these two parallel spins, they move completely independently. This parallel spins are called a spin-on. So you see, this is like a new quasi-particle because it's called like photon, electron. This is called a spin-on because it's an excitation of a spin. And the hole-on also moves independently because it's a hole-on. I mean, it's a positive particle that moves towards the left. So now we've found some new, completely new quasi-particles that come up and arise because of interactions in the system. Nearly 30 years ago, I want to show you this result because it has to do with something that's completely new. In a paper we published when I was a student, I was doing my finishing my PhD, imagine I'm talking about many years ago, we studied numerically the evolution of an electron in an interacting system. So what we had is, this is numerically exact. So we had a very old computer, classical computer, of course. And we have a system, imagine a ring that has 16 sites, and we have interacting electrons in that ring. Now, if we add an electron to the system and we make it move, we make that electron move, if the electron does not interact with the rest of the electrons, and this is no interaction, means this parameter U equal to zero, I'm plotting the movement of this extra particle we're adding, but we measure what is called the charge and the spin densities defined like this. Doesn't matter, I mean, if you're not expert, this is only for people who could understand this, but plus is charge and minus is spin. If the system is not interacting, the charge and the spin of the electron, they move together. So here you see these two humps, charge and spin, they move together towards the right. You see this is, the time is down, it goes in the downwards direction. So the charge and spin are always together. That means the electron is moving around the system. Now, what happens if we put strong interactions in the system? U is equal to 10. I mean, it's a very strongly interacting system. If you see, the charge starts moving, but the spin density, there's a degree of freedom of the spin, does not move so much, and they separate completely, you see, the charge and the spin. So here we have found a way of showing that the charge and the spin of the electrons can go around independently. So it was a surprise now, not long ago, a month ago, when I found this article in the archive. The archive is a repository where we're free to find all the newest and all the articles that are published in physics, and there's also for other fields. The Google Artificial Intelligence Quantum Group and other collaborators, they obtained exactly the same results we had obtained with a classical computer, but with a Google Sycamore computer. So these results you're seeing here are very, very fresh results. This is of October now, a month ago, where they entitled their paper as Observation of Separated Dynamics of Charge and Spin in this model. This is the interacting model, doesn't matter the name. So they have the Sycamore computer with the qubits, and they can simulate the electrons, interacting electrons and the electrons we add, et cetera, and they can also measure the charge and the spin. The charge is blue, the spin is red, and then as a function of time, they evolve these wave packets, because it's a quantum system, they evolve, and you see the charge and the spin evolve in a different way, exactly the same as what we calculated nearly 30 years ago, and in fact, they cite our paper, so we're very happy with that. So this is, they use this Sycamore quantum computer, which is using superconducting resonators. I mean, this is the each of the qubits. So, well, we were very happy with this result, and this is really, really very impressive, and it's a disruptive result, because it's the first time an experiment, a simulation is done in a quantum computer in which they can predict or simulate quantum behavior in materials. So this is the computer. I mean, this is not a computer. This is these are the gates and the control gates, and then they have many other gates and the qubits, etc. It looks very complicated. This is how they put interactions and the matrices that are used to evolve in time, etc., etc. I mean, all this is very cryptic. But this is the, I don't understand the details either, but this is the way they program the qubit in order to simulate a physical system. Well, let me give you other examples of emergent behavior in quantum in quantum matter. One very important result is the ultra-cold atomic gases. This is a new state of matter, because they found in these experiments, Weinmann, Cornell, and Ketterle in 1995, they got the Nobel Prize in 2001. They put together, I mean, many times basic science advances and progresses thanks to important advances in technology. And this is an important advance in the technology of trapping atoms in confined systems. And by trapping atoms, they could show, I mean, this is a velocity distribution, doesn't matter, but what they found is what is called the Bose-Einstein condensation. When all these atoms, they go on all together to the ground state, to the basic state, to the basic quantum state, and they, because they're bosons, I mean, this is a particular statistics of these atoms, and they form only one state, and this is the state means that they have zero velocity in the center. So this picture is showing how all the atoms are going to only one quantum state, a coherent quantum state. This is called the fifth state of matter. The fourth state of matter will be the plasma, and then we have the other three we know, gas, solid, and liquid. So then we have plasma, and Bose-Einstein condensation would be the fifth state of matter. This experiment was done in June in this year in the Cold Atom Laboratory experiment on board the International Space Station. And they also successfully created the Bose-Einstein condensation in the absence of gravity. Let me go quickly to superconductors. Superconductivity is also a Bose condensation. The problem is that what is a superconductor? A superconductor is a material that conducts electricity without dissipation. That means that we couldn't have an iron, or we couldn't have light bulbs, resistivity light bulbs, because the electrons flow in the materials without resistance. So they do not scatter with the individual underlying crystal structure. So superconductivity is also a macroscopic manifestation of quantum mechanics. It's a coherent state where all the electrons go hand in hand together and they flow freely by the material. And this is a very important state of matter. As you see here, that happens below a certain temperature. And what happened in 1986 is that in Zurich, these two people, Bernos and Müller, they discovered superconductivity, but at high temperature. High temperature means above 30 Kelvin. This is the progression of the critical temperatures below which the systems become superconducting as a function of year. And now people are looking for the ambient temperature superconductivity. You see how complex the materials are. They're formed by rare earth, transition metal, and transition metal oxides. They have copper, barium, yttrium, lanthanum. They even have mercury, etc. So this is what we study and what we have to simulate. So, well, HTC is not understood, not even the normal state of these materials. And the discovery of HTC catalyzed research in systems with strongly correlated electrons and many-body systems. These systems are one of the most complex and fascinating systems we encounter today. So why? Because these systems are complex, and complexity is a scientific concept that means that the difficulty grows exponentially with system size or with different parameters. So as the amount of states grows so much, so quickly, and it's really exponential, one must, as I said before, one must optimize the information. And to optimize the information, we can use quantum optimization using quantum information concepts. Let me just tell you an example, a very simple example. It's called the Heisenberg model, but doesn't matter. Here we have n sites. Imagine that we have n qubits. Each of these sites can have two values, a one or a zero. Okay, this is also how quantum computers work. Imagine each site has a one or a zero. This can also have one or zero, one or zero. Now, how many different configurations can you make with these n sites? If each site can have two configurations, it's two times two times two, so it's two to the n. Here you see why it is exponential, because the number of states in the system grows exponentially with its size. So this is what makes it impossible to calculate with a classical computer. And if I put this in a quantum computer, then with only a couple of steps, then it really calculates all what I need. So John Preskill said in the year 2000 something that's very interesting about quantum information. It's a new perspective on quantum mechanics. He said that the most challenging and interesting problems in quantum dynamics involve understanding the behavior of strongly coupled many-body systems. So better ways of characterizing the features of many particle entanglements may lead to new and more effective methods for understanding the dynamical behavior of complex quantum systems. So again, he proposes that something that is very important nowadays is to optimize the quantum information to be able to extract the most important information and properties of the systems. We do this. This is a very, very, sketchy way of showing what we do. We grow the system like this. The system we're calculating, our model, and we divide the model in two. And in part of the model, we try to find. We have to calculate matrices, and we have to diagonalize those matrices. There's a lot of mathematics, and then by diagonalizing those matrices, there's a way of keeping the most important quantum information. We don't have to use all the exponentially large amount of states. But what we do is we reduce it very, very heavily, and we keep very few states, and those are the most important states in the system. Just to finish, this is the model we're studying. For example, we have different layers of particles. Like here, we have one layer, another layer. This is called the two-orbital Hubbard model. And what we do, the red things are dots are electrons. They can hop to the void sites. And when the electrons can be together in the same site, but due to Pauli principle, they can only be up and down. And here they pair a repulsion energy. So what we find by calculating numerically, these are called densities of states that I'm showing here, doesn't matter, the details. What we find, this shows you that as a function of energy, how many electronic states of the material are found for each energy. So here you have many, many states. Here we have no states at zero. The zero is called a Fermi energy. If we have no states, the system is an insulator. If we have states like here, the system is metallic. And what we found is a very, very poignant or very important peaks at certain energies. These black peaks here, they indicate that there is a new quasi-particle. And with this new quasi-particle, I mean, there's a particular state where we find states like this that we call quasi-particles. So we find that in this model, we find entities that move in an independent way. Entities are formed by two particles, two electrons, and a hole. And this thing, this whole thing, moves independently. So so this is the most important feature. It doesn't matter how the other electrons are, but we know that we have an excitation formed by these excitonic particles. Okay, so just to finish, I want to thank my main collaborators, which is this long list of people here, I mean, from many different parts of the world and other institutions. I mean, one does not work alone. Science is collaborative. That's why we always write in plural. We found this and we found that. So thanks to my collaborators. And so my students too, which I want to thank them particularly because they keep me active and interested. Naira Okar and Hernan Fernandez Garcia, And just I wanted to pinpoint here to call the attention that out of about 100 or something collaborators, I've only collaborated with three women, three or four women, and this is about a 10%. So this is a problem we have in science now. I mean, this is something that is we have to try to revert, and this implies a big cultural change we have to have and to promote women, young women, to get involved into science and to promote women to stay in science once they're in science. This has to change completely. It cannot be that there are only three women in a list of 30 people. So well, this is to finish now, just showing you the Fitzroy in Patagonia. to finish, I mean, my final conclusion is that correlated quantum matter is one of the most interesting, complex, and challenging areas in science. So we're just beginning to unveil its mysteries, and there's a long but fascinating way ahead. So thank you all so much for being here and for sharing this moment with me.
Thank you very much, Karen. That was tremendous. That was a lot of deep science. Really appreciate that. Online audience, use hashtag PILive to keep sending in questions. I do have a list of questions already here, but we'll get through as many as we can and let's see how this goes. This is great. So the first question, and I just moved everything. There we go. So first question, this is an online question, Karen. It says, superconductors are often cited as an example of quantum matter. What are some others that exist or may exist one day?
So I don't understand the question. So what is the last question, the last part of the question?
So again? When people talk about quantum matter, superconductors always come up as a nice example. Are there other examples that are equally that will resonate with the, you know, a common person, just like that we would recognize, or maybe one that'll be there one day?
Quantum matter is used for matter that has quantum behavior. So when you look at the macroscopic behavior or even the macroscopic manifestation could be quantum. But for example, I can mention plasma. A plasma is at a very high temperature where the atoms are separated. You have the nuclei separated from the electrons, and this is a completely excited a mixture of atoms, of atomic states, of atoms, I mean. And this is it has to be a very high temperature because you have to strip off all the electrons of the atom. That's another state of matter. It's also quantum matter. It shows quantum properties. Not only superconductivity, but all the properties, for example, magnetic properties in materials, piezoelectric, ferroelectric, all those are properties, magnetism, ferromagnetism, antiferromagnetism, even gap system, the semiconductors, when you dope semiconductors, how the energy, the transport properties depend, all that is quantum matter. There are many, many different ones. So I hope to have responded properly.
Oh, that sounds great. Here's another, this question's from YouTube. Once quantum computers are realized, will classical computers become obsolete?
Not at all, no, because quantum computers are not the solution to everything. They are very good, but they are going to be useful for certain things. The quantum supremacy that Google claims to have had, but it's disputed by others, mainly by IBM, for example, it was to generate a random number. So that's not very useful now, but this could be useful in the future. Classical computers, when quantum computers are functioning, I mean, I would say 10, 20 years, classical computers will be still used for many, many different things. We don't need quantum computers to do simple calculations or even for our smartphones or to manage our computers. We won't need quantum computers for that. It would be very cumbersome to use quantum computers. They will be useful, but for certain things.
Oh, thank you. Here's another online question. You have been a strong advocate for women in physics. What would you tell a young woman interested in a career in physics?
What would I tell? Well, yes, welcome, please. Well, no, I always tell my own kids, follow your dreams, do whatever you're more passionate about. And of course, women that want to do science are very welcome because they're very few. And very few means why are they very few? I mean, there's no reason that there should not be a parity in number of women and men working in physics. The problem is cultural. And it's not that women are less rational or they have more empathy. It's not that. It's women can have the same analytical reasoning as men. There's no point in even posing that question if women think in a different way. So science is completely welcome to women. There must be more women and more young people. We need much more science in the world, and mainly in the developing world, like in my country, for example. But if you want to join science and do science, it's really passionate. You have difficult moments, of course. Sometimes you say, why am I so... I asked a question, but this question wasn't the right way. I have to correct. There are very few moments where you have a reward, but what moments? Those are very nice moments.
Thank you. That was great. This one just came in, and this is also from YouTube, so it's going back to the quantum matter and quantum states. It says, how will new states of matter impact my personal life? That's a hard question, perhaps.
Semiconductors were discovered in the middle of last century, and that has definitely impacted your life because we couldn't be even talking in this moment because it's the basic, as I said, of our transistors and of the modern electronic technology. So new states of matter, you don't have to think of a state of matter, new quantum properties, let's say more broadly, will definitely bring changes. And this depends on how we develop, apply these new discoveries in basic science, because basic science, look what happened with a transistor. Semiconductors were discovered in the middle of last century, and it took several decades until it was really applied and until devices were developed. So yes, we have to continue. There's a lot out there. I mean, every time we advance and we know more, we realize we know less in proportion, because every step we advance in science, that opens a whole new bunch of new questions, and this is also exponential, I say.
Very good, very good. All right, shall we try a new thing, or do our lightning round that we discussed? The team put some good questions together. So okay. I guess we need ground rules. The ground rules are you can answer it in a one word or a phrase, and you can also say pass if we've come up with a question that just doesn't work. And I think there's five of them. All right, here we go. Speed round. Do you have a favorite equation or quantum material?
The Schrödinger equation.
One scientist, dead or alive, that you most want to meet?
Well, Marie Curie.
development in quantum matter you're most excited to see?
Room temperature superconductivity.
When do you expect to see it?
People claim they have it already, but I'm not sure. So as soon as possible, ASAP.
Excellent. Biggest influence on your career, scientific or otherwise?
My two kids.
Oh, awesome. And most important trait for a successful physics career?
Most important trait? Passion.
Oh, that's the perfect thing to finish on. I can't thank you enough for joining us, for using that transistor technology from so many years ago to come into our living rooms and into Perimeter from half a world away. It's been a real, real pleasure. So thank you so much.
Yes, thank you to me. I really hope I could all meet you in person. It would have been a different thing, but well, at least we have this. So thank you very much, all of you, all the audience. I thank you, organizers, once again.
Thank you. A real pleasure. Yes, and we will do this again when we can meet in person. And to our online audience, I want to say thank you for joining us for this last lecture of 2020. We wish you the happiest of holidays. Stay safe, stay home, and hope you can celebrate with your friends and family virtually. Take care, everyone. Good night.